Hello and welcome back to another episode of Election Watch. My name is Rhys and today we are going to be talking all about the Conservative Party leadership race. They are down to two candidates to replace Boris Johnson. Rishi Sunak, the former Chancellor, whose resignation was one of two within 20 minutes that sparked a cabinet coup, forcing the former Prime Minister out of office. And the other, Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, remarkably quiet over Boris Johnson's summary execution by Conservative Party members. But now she's on both as the continuity candidate and the tax-cutting revolutionary. But we'll have to have a look first at how we got down to these two and where they might go with the country. Joining me on a slightly larger panel than we've been getting used to, because we are joined by one additional member who've been trying to get on the podcast for a while. We have our, I feel fine in saying regulars now. We have Vicky, who is going to be going into the head of news position at Expression FM. So whether you're listening to that through a link you got from one of Expression FM's sites, keep an ear out for Vicky next year behind the hosting microphone. And Callum, who you will have heard a number of times on news shows, my show on Wednesdays on Expression. But we are also joined by my former co-head of news for her first appearance on Election Watch. It's Laura. So I just want to say hi, guys. How are you? How are you all doing? It's been a little bit of a while since we recorded, and it's been a while since I recorded anything with you, Laura. So how are we all getting on before we delve into the issue of politics?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you, Rhys. It's nice to see you guys. I know it's over Zoom, but it's been a while. I've just been enjoying summer, to be honest. I think after 4 years, I kind of died a bit. This just went for a long nap. But I've woken up and I'm here today to join you guys. How are you guys doing?
No, doing well. Likely the fact that politics is like very much keeping up over the summer after dying down. It feels like every day there's a new outlet, like thing happening, and it's very nice to be sitting in a meeting trying to work out what we're doing next year with a sub headline on our document called "What if there's a general election?" So that's a fun outreach. We were really hoping there isn't one in the first term, but we have a plan. So
yeah, general election is going to be an interesting one, both as someone who's going into the civil service and as someone who's kind of responsible for kind of keeping helping out stations from across the region as well. That's going to be an interesting one to watch. But we'll go more into political analysis, but likelihood of that is an interesting point of discussion, I'd say.
Absolutely, definitely an interesting one there. And, you know, as someone involved in regional coordination for student radio stations in the Southwest, maybe we can get a regional newsroom to help share the load if there is to be a general election. Keep coverage going from syndicated stations all night if we have to. But you heard it here first if it does happen. And you never know. Maybe there's an idea somewhere in and around all this clutter in my head. Something that has got a large proportion less cluttered over the last few weeks and months is the field of candidates to replace Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. So that's what we're going to be talking about in today's Election Watch. Election Watch. We're now down to two, of course, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, as I mentioned in the introduction. But I want to take us back in time a little bit, back to just after Boris Johnson announced that he would be standing down as leader of the Conservative Party in order to allow this leadership race to occur, when we had seemingly an ever-enlarging field of candidates to replace him. Now, we know that Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss were in there. You also had Penny Mordaunt. Who else did we have? Suella Braverman, Tom Tugendhat, Kemi Badenoch. Jeremy Hunt was in there, although he got kicked out of the race fairly unceremoniously and fairly early for someone who pushed Boris Johnson all the way to the final round in the last time they had a leadership election in 2019. But then you also had some people who didn't even make it onto the ballot paper. Grant Shapps was often mooted as trying to launch a bid. I don't think he ever officially confirmed one in the end. But you also had the assassin-in-chief, if you will, Sajid Javid, someone who people have been thinking, well, he was going to stand a good chance to be the next prime minister. He withdrew before MPs even got a chance to vote. And then there was this left-field candidate, Remen Chishti, who I think gathered the official support of no members of the Conservative Party in Parliament and withdrew at the same time as Sajid Javid. But with that wide field of candidates, how is it that we've ended up with Sunak and Truss? What do we think?
I think it tells a real story about how far right the Conservative Party has gone in recent years. Some of the candidates you just listed, people like Jeremy Hunt, maybe even Sajid Javid, and Tom Tugendhat, who got further through, kind of represent more of the One Nation Conservative Party we saw under David Cameron. That kind of wing of the party, which has been quietly kind of pushing further and further away from power as Boris Johnson climbed the ranks. So the fact that they fared so badly in comparison to people like Kemi Badenoch, who definitely isn't a One Nation kind of Conservative type person, really speaks to how the Conservative Party and the Conservative Party membership has shifted further and further away from where polling would suggest the majority of the country are. And I think it's quite interesting when we were looking at, like, when Corbyn rose to the leadership, people going, well, the membership love him, but the general public don't. And how are they ever going to elect a winning leader ever again if the membership and the general public are so far apart? And I think you might be looking at the same thing in the Conservative Party.
I think there's an element also of which candidates are well known. You can't ignore that fact. You've got Rishi Sunak, who obviously is a well-known candidate amongst MPs, but mainly the general population, whether that be for the reduction in beer prices and the 5p reduction on your petrol, which we covered on Expression FM, or if it's for the controversy around his wife's non-dom status or his £180 thermos, which is quite an interesting... Yeah, fact about Rishi Sunak. But then you've got Liz Truss, who has been known for her position as Foreign Secretary, especially with the Ukraine war, but also for the fact that with such a large number of controversies that inevitably ended in Boris Johnson's stepping down, she has been one of the least controversial MPs. If you talk about, you have Rishi Sunak with his... fines for Partygate, and then you have the interview recently of whether she attended one and she has not been fined and her response was no. So I think that is a large reason why we are left with these two. One, the one who's known to be more charismatic and well known amongst MPs and the general public, and the other who hasn't had as many controversies.
Yeah, there's a certain element, especially with particularly with Sunak's campaign, of kind of trying to ride wave of the pandemic response in a sense, or at least some of the more positive sides. I would say that a lot of his campaign has been built on the popularity he gained with the Eat Out to Help Out scheme and the furlough schemes during lockdowns, certainly. Though it should be said, by no means were there were certainly, by no means, whilst there are certainly kind of more extreme views from these two, as we'll probably get on to, they were not the only kind of more extreme members of the party in the mix. Take, for example, Kemi Badenoch, who despite being a former equalities minister, was very happy about the Tavistock service being, or as they called it, Tavistock scandal, what is one of the principal gender-affirming healthcare centres for young people being shut down in the country. And they were happy about it and just claimed it was showing the dangers of civil service groupthink. I mean, that was in the last few days, but yes, as you mentioned in the lead, as Vicky mentioned, this is not the Conservative Party of David Cameron or previous iterations, wherein I think even Margaret Thatcher, who many of these people epitomise as the best Conservative, would probably struggle to recognise her own party from this.
It's interesting you mention Margaret Thatcher. I'm sure we'll come on to why that is particularly interesting in a little bit when we delve deeper into the two candidates at the sharp end of this contest. I do just want to briefly talk about the three candidates who sort of pushed them the furthest. Penny Mordaunt, Tom Tugendhat and Kemi Badenoch. All three representing sort of quite divergent sides of the Conservative Party, really. Tom Tugendhat, comfortably the most One Nation Conservative in the race, let alone in the final five. He seemed to have the same level of pull within members that Jeremy Hunt, or the same style of pull that Jeremy Hunt would have been able to get. Very much someone who has built their career on a record of service, and they're trying to play themselves as this very One Nation consensus building type of Conservative. I remember from that first debate where he was asked whether Boris Johnson was trustworthy, and he just shook his head and just walking away. Very different from Boris Johnson's style of Conservative Party. You then move on to Kemi Badenoch, who is almost sort of Boris Johnson by another name in terms of the almost dog whistle style of politics that you're seeing. It's very populist, and I know people throw around populist as a dirty word, but there's nothing inherently wrong with appealing to the populace. That is, after all, the name of the game in politics. But this seems to be aggressively populist in terms of anything we can do that will get the attention of voters, or that will get the people who we like to support us, will do that. It doesn't matter if it's a well-thought-out policy, a multi-line policy, or just one word or three words in a slogan. Don't go woke, I think, was one of the ones that Kemi Badenoch was using over the course of her leadership campaign. She pitched herself as this anti-woke grassroots candidate. But then you turn to Penny Mordaunt, who is a curious hybrid of the two. Now, Penny Mordaunt has often been one of the Conservative Party's longest standing and most vocal supporters of trans rights, of gender equality, of sexual identity equality, and all sorts of other quite forward-thinking and socially liberal issues that you might comfortably define those groupings as. But over the course of this leadership campaign, we saw her almost lose that identity, or at least sort of try and dampen it to calm down members. But she was the most popular with members. It was quite clear to see over the course of polling, up until that final one, that final round where Liz Truss overtook her for the first time amongst Conservative members of Parliament. Penny Mordaunt was always in second place to Rishi Sunak amongst members of Parliament, but beating every single other candidate in the 1v1 polling. But with not really too much of a fixed identity, this sort of fluctuating Conservative Party that bounces from One Nation to Disraelite, then back to Peelite, and all the way over across to Thatcherite in one sentence sometimes, you can almost accuse some Conservative spokespeople of. So I just wondered what your guys' opinions were on those three candidates and why they really failed to get past the members of Parliament in order to put their pitch to the 160 or so thousand Conservative members.
I mean, in terms of whether we can count it as a failure, I think for lots of them, they wouldn't necessarily count it as a failure. I imagine Tom feels quite secure in the launch. He'll probably have a cabinet position, maybe even foreign secretary under Liz Truss or Rishi. And that's going to be a step forward in his career and probably something he'd be more interested in doing. That foreign policy is kind of where his expertise is. Kemi has definitely raised her profile. I remember when she announced, everyone was like, sorry, who is this woman? I have never seen her before. And why is Michael Gove backing her? And so I think she's definitely raised her profile and could be looking into kind of cabinet positions as well. I think I saw a YouGov poll or another polling firm poll Conservative members, and she was the MP they most wanted to see in a cabinet. There was like strong support for her. And then Penny, really, I mean, of course, it must feel like a failure because she very nearly got through to the members, and then who knows what would have happened then. But again, has kind of come out of nowhere. She hasn't had a cabinet position for a while, best known for appearing on Splash. Like, she, so I think it's like they failed, they didn't really necessarily fail. It's what Laura was talking about, a name ID, and Rishi and Liz just had that. More than they did, must have had more organization like and roots and links within the party to get kind of MPs votes, and that's what helped them in the end.
I feel that that's definitely, I agree with Vicky, it's what really pushed them forward and pushed and separated the other three, like Vicky and like probably the rest of the people on this panel. When the three candidates came up, most of them I'd never heard of before. I think one of the things that definitely did separate them as well, one of the aspects was the kind of what Rhys touched on, the more straightforward, direct style of talking, like with the head shakes from Tom, etc. I think it's very different from the style of speech and prose that we see from Boris and those who follow him. It's less of the, for lack of a better word, wishy-washy political attributes and gestures. I think, I mean, undeniably for Penny, I think the last thing some her followers would say was a character assassination that pushed her away from being in the top two. Which I just find it very interesting for me. I think I feel that if you're in cabinet and you're with people or the other people around you who are fighting for the position, you want to be pushed and you're being voted by your other members of parliament. People are going to vote for people who at the end of the day they think are going to do the best job. And the fact that Penny's character assassinations was that she doesn't pull her weight and doesn't do the job that she wants, she has already being given, how is she going to do the job of being prime minister of the country, really, really does hold a great weight.
I entirely agree that it was just on name recognition mostly for why we have these two candidates as the last two. It's just simply, I mean, taking from example from our conversations, I think I got Tom Tugend that confused with a American politician briefly, who just simply by I can't quite remember the circumstances for it, but that kind of goes to show that this was someone who was a candidate to lead the majority party, and so therefore the country, and a good chunk of people in the general public, and probably a good chunk of people within the party, weren't aware of who he was, or at least that's one case. And yeah, there's a lot to be said. Also, there, I think by nature of being in senior cabinet positions already, there was something where Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss could be said to be more media savvy as well, certainly, at least in representation of their politics, having, you know, that kind of established base or established image in the press more so as well. So I think definitely... yeah, I think there was a few factors at play, but I think in terms of it, it was mainly just by name recognition, because we couldn't distinguish politics enough. Like we had no predictions of who would be the winner of this when the first candidates came out based on politics alone. So it all boiled down to essentially popularity and recognition.
Now that we've had a little bit of a talk about the also-ran sort of, and again, I agree with a lot of the points that have been made there. Tom Tugendhat looks like he's sort of nailed on for some sort of either junior cabinet position or one of the more sort of, what's the word, prestigious junior ministerial posts, something within the Department of Defence or the Foreign Office, something like that. all depends on Ben Wallace for me about Tom Tugendhat. If he gets moved on to Foreign by Liz Truss vacating Foreign, then Tom Tugendhat looks like a shoe-in for Defence. The same goes for Penny Mordaunt, who, all right, was a little bit character assassinated in those last few rounds, but has still done enough to prove that she is popular with the members enough to get into a cabinet position. And Kemi Badenoch, again, she's definitely done enough to get back into cabinet. The former equalities minister, of course, as Callum, you mentioned earlier on, I wouldn't be too surprised to see her sat round that cabinet table. But yeah, let's move on now to the two people who, if you look at it without any polling figures, they each have an equal chance of being the next prime minister. If you look at it with polling figures attached, it's Liz Truss's to lose and Rishi Sunak has everything to gain. Interestingly enough, if any of us had been in Exeter today, we'd have been just about in time for a hustings at 7 o'clock as we sit here recording this. Ballot papers are starting to be sent out. So now is really the time where that polling lead for Liz Truss starts to become a real worry for Rishi Sunak, as far as I'm concerned, because before polling cards are out, or in terms of a general election, you'd think before polling day, the polls can say almost whatever they want. And as a political figure, you can say, right, I take notice of it, but it doesn't really bother me, as long as you're still making some sort of momentum. Now, with this being an all mail-in ballot, as far as I'm aware, or at least most of these ones that are landing on members' doormats, these ballot papers are going to be mail-ins. They've already been sent out. Rishi Sunak needs to be very careful about letting Liz Truss hold this lead for too long. And with that, we now have to turn to why Liz Truss has a lead. And if getting through to the final two has been a battle of personality over policy, then it does look like this final two, although it's not major policy differences and it's not long-standing policy differences that are going to cause these divides between Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak's campaigns, it does look like there is going to be more of an emphasis on policy, specifically tax policy. Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor who raised taxes to their highest peacetime level since the Second World War, is saying we are not in a financial position to bring down taxes right now. We're not in a position to bring down any of those taxes. He's going to take 4p off income tax within 7 years, though, as a little dangling of a carrot for the next general election. Whereas Liz Truss, very much in a traditionally fiscally conservative manner, is saying cut the tax thresholds now. Make sure we are lowering the tax burden on people up and down the country. I wonder what our panel here think of these two and where they stand on their tax policy. Do you feel they're effectively conveying what they think and what they want? And do you think it's coming across well with Conservative members?
I mean, going off the debates, I think Rishi's tax policy, he does genuinely believe and has put quite a lot of long time thinking about. He seems to, like, when he speaks about it, even if you don't agree with what he's saying, he seems very well versed in what he is saying, what his actual policy is, and why he's putting it forward, even if you don't necessarily agree with that. Liz Truss, on the other hand, to me, seems a bit out of her depth, and like she just thought, I'll cut taxes, that's popular, and I'll worry about the kind of details of what actually happens and how I do that later. I don't think she kind of seems as comfortable talking about the economy and kind of just going for popular appeal rather than actual thought through plans, which is a bit of a worry, but it doesn't seem to have affected the Conservative base at all, who seem to have heard tax cuts and kind of just stopped there and been happy.
She keeps on referring to the idea of that we have £30 billion of fiscal headroom. And as we know, with the increased inflation, this is going to be eaten through very, very quickly. So it's all well and good waving a big fancy number and telling everyone that is going to save us, and don't worry, we have the safety net, when the reality is we are not in a great position. We're already in £19.1 billion in debt, which is the highest on record. So with the way things are going, cost of living crisis, inflation, it's probably not looking great.
Not by any stretch, no, it's not looking great. But at the same time, especially in modern politics, that message of short-term relief of tax cuts is going to land far more than Rishi Sunak's longer-term plans, as well thought out as they may be. It is going, I mean, just looking at the last few years, considering the rate of turnover that we've had of conservative leaders, it's hard to say that it would be in a place to implement those longer term plans. So people are going to be looking for those people with quick solutions, with the short term plans, not necessarily those long term goals, because Lorna does this. Probably a fair bit of sentiment that it's not necessarily going to be the case that they're going to be in that position. No consideration of whether the Conservatives at all are going to be in power. That's an entirely different discussion. But the persons themselves, are they going to be in that position in however long it's going to take to fully implement this plan?
It feels like they're playing hot potato and just like chucking all the problems on to the next one coming. Like, we'll sort it now and pass it on to the next, just with a lot of their policies. A lot of quick fixes are in place, but like, that's the way it goes.
That's certainly been an increasingly worrying trend in modern politics, and you can't level it at one party or another realistically without being grossly hypocritical. And you probably can't define a direct point as to where things became so short-termist in view. You can almost put it down to the breakup of the post-war consensus. And the corporatist ideals that came through from all the governments up until around James Callaghan, although you could say that that was the death knell of the two-party consensus between Labour and the Conservatives on how to run the economy. Since then, and this is across the world as well, it's not just in the United Kingdom, we now see things that are for very much short-term goals, and the long-term does seem to be forgotten a bit, because we're now in these very high turnaround, very high publicized election cycles where you have to win the next election. And leaders don't get a chance after they lose an election now. If you look back to some of the great leaders of both the major parties in the UK from decades gone by, Winston Churchill and Clement Attlee, before they had their longest elected times as prime minister, both of them lost major general elections. Churchill, the 45 election, Attlee lost the 1935 general election. He was still there 10 years later to come around and sweep Labour to power. If Keir Starmer loses in 2024 or whenever it is, he's going to be out on his arse with no payout from the Labour Party. It's do not pass go, do not collect £200, go directly to jail. A new leader will come in and take your place in the morning. That's the sort of political world we're in. And this turnover of Boris Johnson, although it's for different reasons than just unelectability, and I'm not for one moment saying that that is an example of a leader being treated unfairly, but if we are to look at it on face value, where so much was ignored before the tipping point, this is about an electability crisis for the Conservative Party, and they've made this short-term decision to go, we're so far behind in the polls, we will probably lose the next general election. Let's have a new leader. Same thing happened for Theresa May. David Cameron made the political calculation before he could be axed by his own party. It really is short-termism on a massive scale. And just to add to one of those things you said earlier, Laura, about the national debt, it's way bigger than that. It's now £2.2 trillion is the UK's gross government debt, which is 106% of gross domestic product. That's only from the year ending March 2021, the financial year as well. Take into account net debt, and we start to get differing figures, but I'm going to stick with gross debt for versus GDP on that one. That's the economist in me talking. But this really does put the candidates in a very difficult position. Rishi Sunak clearly wants to cut taxes, but he doesn't see himself as a position to do so. But whilst he keeps himself on this level, he's keeping taxes at all-time highs, pretty much. Liz Truss, as you say, her expertise probably doesn't lie in economic policy. That's why she's never worked in a Treasury department after being Chief Secretary. She was moved out quite swiftly from there, went around Justice, Women and Equalities, Trade, and now in Foreign Office. Her expertise in terms of governmental experience is not the economy. Rishi Sunak's is. He's enunciating his tax policy far more clearly, even if it's not what members want to hear. Let's turn now to things that are other than economic policy. And let's turn to the rest of the world, because I know that the economy often dominates, and quite right. I mean, what was that famous line by Bill Clinton's campaign advisor? It's the economy, stupid. When you're talking about what sort of campaign you have to run, how you have to convince people, you have to convince them that you will be a good steward of the public finances. Otherwise, they will never believe you when you say you're going to get anything done. That's what crippled Labour in the 1980s. They were seen as a tax and spend striking economy. It's what brought down New Labour after the financial crisis. They were no longer seen as stewards of the economy. So that's the key foundational element. But alongside that, especially at a time where international tensions are getting to the highest levels we've seen since the Cold War, some would say higher, given the breakout of an active major power war on the European continent. Something we haven't seen, as I say, with these major powers since World War II. And if we look back to all wars since, realistically, the Yugoslav War, Rishi Sunak just does not talk about foreign policy because he's never worked in it. He became an MP in 2015 after leaving the banking and finance industry. His first cabinet job was in the was in the Treasury in government. He then became Chief Secretary to the Treasury under Sajid Javid, and then took his boss's job to become Chancellor. That puts Liz Truss in a phenomenally strong position to talk with conviction, if not always total sense, about the state of foreign policy and trade agreements in the world. So how do you see this foreign and international policy debate lining up between these two candidates? And is there something I've missed about Rishi Sunak that strikes you as he's better at foreign policy than we think?
In terms of Rishi Sunak, the only thing on foreign policy I've seen from him is about combating China, which had some kind of suggestions I think I've also heard from Liz Truss and kind of just kind of everyone. There was nothing kind of new there, apart from, I think, creating a kind of new Five Eyes program, but without one of the five countries, but I can't remember which one he didn't include in that for some reason. Liz Truss, however, this is an area she has an advantage, even if sometimes when she's talking, she does seem to be glossing over something she missed, didn't do or got wrong. But she was foreign secretary. She's stood in Red Square with her furry hat on. She's played all the big hits. So she has that kind of background to draw upon. And she has been. I've seen lots from her supporters talking about how she has the backing of several Ukrainian MPs, because of course she does. She's seen as a massive Russiaphobe. They know she's fighting that battle. They don't know what Rishi Sunak will be doing, because no one knows what Rishi Sunak will be doing, because he's never done anything foreign policy related. So even if she isn't speaking, I don't think she's making the most advantage of it, because I don't think she's given a very clear foreign policy speech. I think she could have done a lot better in that area. It is still an area she's got an advantage.
I agree with Vicky. She obviously does have an advantage. Again, as Vicky said, the only thing I've also heard is about combating China from both of them, which is quite funny, seeing as I think it was a year ago Rishi was advising Johnson to make sure to keep their trade deals. So there we go, back to our economic policies or economic aspirations there. But when it comes to Liz Truss, I think, yeah, she does definitely have the advantage, but she definitely does have an advantage, but it's not as great as everyone thinks it is. And I think it can definitely be inflated. She said that she has created, throughout her time as Foreign Secretary, she has negotiated 60 deals. Most of them are rollover deals that we had previously before Brexit. The only two that she has created was with Australia, New Zealand, I think. And I think the Australia one is suggested that over the next 15 years, GDP will increase by 0.08%. But other than that, yes, it's true, she has negotiated deals, but I do think she has enhanced and inflamed as much of her what she has achieved in when it comes to foreign policy.
I just want to quickly jump on that as well. Rishi Sunak almost scored an own goal during his time as Chancellor in how much he's been hyping up, along with other cabinet members, the importance of these, I think it's up to 68 new trade deals, or in inverted commas, new trade deals that Liz Truss was able to negotiate in a time of international trade. You're quite right to say, Laura, that all bar two are rollover deals. And it's 0.08 in 15 years. In real terms, in the short term, in about 5 years to 10 years, it's going to take a 2% cut in our net trade balance from Australia, which is bad. So Rishi Sunak scored an own goal, because now it's almost too late for the entire, in fact, it is too late for the Conservative Party to turn around and say, well, actually, these deals aren't all that great, because it's all they've been talking about over the Brexit negotiations. Sorry, I'll leave you guys to carry on.
Yeah, when it comes to foreign policy, certainly the how to deal with China on what the steps to take with China is certainly the biggest kind of differing point in foreign policy when it comes to these two candidates. Obviously, one of the other main crises at the moment, which people would be contending with, is Ukraine, but both have remained fairly committed to the current UK strategy, which is very much try to support Ukraine, but not with direct military action, essentially. And I think both have stated that they would try to maintain this strategy in some sense. So yeah, in terms of, it's interesting that well, by nature of their roles in the cabinet and probably some area of speciality in politics, it's interesting that when it comes to outspoken policies, they haven't tended to branch outside what they're known for, in a sense. I realize that's a point of a wider discussion, but as prime minister, you would hope they would at least have some scope for those wider ideas, even if it was something where, you know, they would be working with advisors to develop a strategy or something along those lines. You would at least hope for some inkling of how are they going to run this fundamental part of the country. But in terms of, you know, in terms of foreign policy from Rishi Sunak, and in terms of economic policy from Liz Truss, whilst not quite like fully silent, is very sparse in what they've said.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about, but I'm going to choose to just sort of move away from foreign policy. We might come back to it in a little bit. And that's something that we have spent most of our lives involved in, and that's education. Because recently we've seen a couple of big announcements in terms of the pull they're meant to give for the Conservative members in relation to education policy. Now, we have someone who is essentially trying to call themselves the Education Prime Minister. That's Liz Truss, by the way, saying that students who get top grades would automatically be invited to apply for Oxford or Cambridge. And that is part of a 6-point plan targeting reform in the education sector. And Liz Truss wrote, I can't quite remember where they wrote it, saying there's a plan to give every child the tools they need to succeed, which includes widening access to top universities, putting less emphasis on predicted grades, and, weirdly enough, allowing students to apply to universities after receiving their A-level grades, which I can only imagine is going to cause the admissions tutors to spontaneously combust in a fit of overworked fury. This is weird, though, because I wonder, does this seem very similar to the Labour Party's proposal in 2019 that was widely shot down by the Conservative Party? It was also warned against by education leaders, but it was supported by the Sutton Trust, who work closely with many disadvantaged students and disadvantaged groups across the country. Rishi Sunak, on the other hand, is looking even earlier than university and is looking at grammar schools. Specifically, he has said categorically that he will lift a ban on the creation of new grammar schools, which is somewhat controversial. Liz Truss hasn't ruled it out. No new grammar schools have been able to be created for, I think it's what, the last 30 or so years now in the United Kingdom. Liz Truss, whilst not officially saying she would end that ban, has said she wants to expand existing high-performing academy schools and replace failing establishments with free schools. So I wonder, given that we all have quite a large degree of personal experience in the education sector as, well, we've been students pretty much all our lives, what do we think about these two candidate sets of policies, and will they work in terms of A, winning them leadership, and B, actually having the effects that they think they'll have on the school systems?
I think I'm going to first tackle the grammar school part of the discussion, because I think, am I the only one who went to grammar school here? I think, yeah. So I went to a grammar school and I really enjoyed it. For me personally, it was the best opportunity in my area. I can afford to go to a private school. My brother went to the comprehensive in the same area, and there was a difference. When I went to my school, it was cool to be intelligent, to get good grades was very much pushed, and you had to do everything for yourself to get your grades. And then when I went to uni, I did notice that difference. Personally, with regards to the grammar school aspect, I have no issue with it. I just wanted to start with that because I don't know if the other people on the call would like to put in a point about grammar school, just to help widen my perspective, seeing as I definitely have a very biased opinion.
I mean, I know it's a really controversial topic, and I've heard the debate lots and lots of times about whether grammar schools were a good idea or not. I'm kind of with you the fact that I didn't go to grammar school, but of people I know who went to grammar school, what I've got is a very positive opinion of like how those schools went. And I would certainly have been like, if there'd been a grammar school in my area, I'm sure my parents would have wanted me to go to it, and I'd have been pushed towards it. In terms of like how much impact it's going to have, I think it's probably overstated, just taking into account that it's going to be a really tight election in even 1 or 2 years' time, and grammar schools take quite a while to build. So like, if we're actually going to see any grammar schools under Rishi Sunak, I think it's unlikely. So I don't think, when people come up either side saying like, oh, it's going to have such a brilliant impact on like all these children who are going to get in, or it's going to have such a detrimental impact for these children who are kind of sent to schools less well off and don't have that push from the more academically able pupils, like, I don't think we're probably going to see a grammar school. So I think both of those results are kind of overstated.
Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, it was very close to a case where I might have ended up going to a grammar school, actually, if my parents hadn't moved from Bristol City in Bristol to Somerset. I would have likely had ended up going to a grammar school. But yeah, from what I've heard, there aren't necessarily negative sides to it. I just think when a lot of the controversy surrounds the amount of money it takes to set one up, and the fact that at the end of the day, it is a there's a threshold to it, and I think that's where a lot of this kind of not necessarily do controversy, but certainly controversy comes from it. But it's definitely one of the more agreeable sections when it comes to the education policy of the of any of the candidates, I would say.
I'm actually going to be bold and actually take an opinion for once in this podcast, and I'm going to come out on the other side to, I think, most of the people on the call. I'm going to put it out straight away. I think what grammar schools do in their current format is very good for the people who go to them. I can see obvious benefits for going to grammar schools, and I'm not against the continuation of existing grammar schools. Where I stand on new grammar schools, though, is the pool of people who go to grammar schools, it will likely be taken from the existing pool of comprehensive school attendees. Now, I'm not saying it will be university. There are going to be some who would have gone to private or fee-paying schools who will now see grammar schools as a good option. And fair enough, if they see the option, go for it. I'm never going to say there should be less or fewer options for people to try and take. But what I will say is, if you're looking at comprehensive schools now, they're already struggling in terms of funding. They're already struggling in terms of place allocation. And what Callum said was quite important in terms of the financial aspects of the establishment of new grammar schools. And I think I'm going to say it, they're selective schools in terms of attendance, which means that if we accept that a lot of those people who may get into grammar schools would be ordinarily those amongst the higher achieving comprehensive school attendees, what is that going to do for the overall quality of education in comprehensive schools, in terms of if there used to be 15-20% of the class who were A star students and they lose half of that to grammar schools potentially? This is all very much hypotheticals, which is why it's almost pointless to go down this rabbit hole so far, but I've started, so I may as well finish. And additional to that, that funding argument, it could be better spent improving the education sector we already have, rather than going back on exactly the same style of policy that Michael Gove was doing when he decided to make GCSEs more like O-levels and deal linear courses. This shameless nostalgia for things that they went through is fine if you're doing the day-to-day upkeep and making sure the school system is good enough as it is before that. So I have no problem with grammar schools. I'm just not sure whether creating new ones at the moment is the best way for either of these candidates to go down.
Yeah, I completely agree, Rhys. From a at the moment and an economic standpoint, it is not viable to create new grammar schools. When it comes to the aspect of you taking away the brightest or the highest grades of the 20% of a comprehensive, I think in my experience, seeing as I live in an area that's surrounded by the two, it actually just means that the children in comprehensive schools get more attention from the teachers and a style of learning that is more suited to them. So grades wise, both are have been quite competitive amongst each other. But I can understand from a setting up an initial standpoint, it'd be very difficult.
I want to just remember one more thing I was going to say there. It was the conversation around the Sutton Trust that got me thinking about this as well. If we're looking at Liz Truss's plans to say that students receiving top grades could automatically be invited to apply to Oxford and Cambridge, that's great on an, what's it called? An achievement ladder, sort of lifting up those who are less advantaged to have the opportunity that they might never have been given before. I'm not saying it's a sticking plaster or a magic cure-all, and I'm not actually saying it's a brilliant plan, but purely in terms of social mobility, that's the word, it does look like it's opening a door for those with less resources and perhaps lower performing schools to have that avenue opened. If we're now saying that to go to these new grammar schools, which could indeed become the norm as they used to be back in the 60s and 70s, then we're looking at potentially, or we're looking at a good proportion of students aged 11 taking entrance exams that could define a good part of their educational mobility. And if we're looking at those with fewer resources, I'm not going to say I'm one of them. I've been very, very lucky throughout my life. I've had lots of advantages and lots of opportunities, but there are some who do not have those. And I wonder whether giving that selection earlier in life could even push them further down into, underachieving what their potential is. But again, I love having proper debates on these sorts of things.
Personally, in my experience, that hasn't been the case, especially when it comes to GCSEs. A lot of the time when it comes to grammar schools have the built-in sixth form centre. So then they outreach specifically to wider areas and wider schools. So children who have achieved stronger GCSE grades can attend the grammar school, and then the children in the grammar schools who didn't achieve the right ones are also under the same level, the same regulations of having to try and re-enter for sixth form. I believe like the numbers are very similar between the grammar school and comprehensive. Maybe that's just where I live or where I've grown up. But I do completely understand that there is almost like an elitist title associated with grammar schools, which is also associated with Oxbridge. But then you can't get rid of the elitist title that is exists with private schools. We need to understand that that still stands, and a lot of them will be entering Oxbridge. So it's either you give some, maybe it's the lesser of two evils if you give some children who don't have the same economic privileges as the children who can enter private schools to go to grammar schools. Maybe they could have that super that same kind of step up entrance in, but at the same time, where I've been, a lot of the children from comprehensive schools have gone to Oxbridge and the grammar school kids have not.
I mean, there's a certain level of kind of postcode lottery at play here, because obviously different areas are going to have different reactions. Like before my year, where there was a few people who'd gone in, there had been a number of students with stellar grades who had applied to Oxbridge, but none had managed to get in. So there is a geographical element to that. And I mean, there is something to be said of it being comprehensive as well. But yeah, I think, but it's also one of those things where, none of us are Oxbridge students as well, but we've had perfectly fine degrees. Whilst I understand there is a certain prestige and a certain, there is definitely like a further glass ceiling about getting people into Oxbridge, surely one of the most more fundamental things is allowing those people who are getting good grades but might be from less represented schools or getting into university more generally. Like, and frankly, from what I've heard from friends and family friends who've gone to Oxbridge, there's an element there where there's going to be students who aren't going to want to go to Oxbridge but are wanting to go to a university in the same sense, and they deserve that same level of support, essentially, because there might be, or at least, but it seems to be that the only support proposed is to help people to get into Oxbridge.
I don't understand how someone who went to Oxbridge forgets that they have their own entrance exams and everything added onto it. I can't fathom why she suddenly thinks, okay, everyone who gets the good grades, straight away we're going to push you to Oxbridge, you're going to get a place. Like, she's selling dreams, she's selling fairy tales, because I have many friends who got predicted all A stars and they achieved them and they were not given a place because they did not pass their interviews, they did not pass their tests that they have to do. It is elitist, it is selective. This has happened for hundreds of years. We're not going to change it. Like Callum said, it's probably better to, the only way that you can add that value, that extra credit to other students, is sometimes to devalue that of these elitist unis by increasing the value of others around them.
I mean, I totally agree with you there, Laura. I was so confused by Liz Truss's policy when I read it. It made no sense to me. I mean, there's two halves to it. The first half is like the overall kind of like, let's change it so you apply for university after you get your grades. And I can see why someone like the Sutton Trust would be in favour of that, because private schools have a whole system in place about boosting predicted grades, boosting personal statements. They have a whole thing in place and that helps people get into university. But overall, I tend to think against that just because I can't see how it works from an admin side unless you change the entire school calendar. And if you change the entire school calendar, you're going to fundamentally mess up at least 1 year, probably more than that. Like, I was the first year of like the new GCSEs, and that was different enough, like being the first year of like a new set of GCSEs, let alone if you like entirely change an academic year and have to work out how to redo it, and when the exams are, and when the results are, and when you find out you're in university, and then how do you do accommodation, and how do you work, and like how long do you have to prep to go to university? That's very quick turnaround, and then clearing and all of that stuff. How does that happen? But her actual policy about Oxbridge, some of my main problems about, like, you brought it up, like, if you're going to promote people to like go higher up into education, why are you only focusing on two universities? And then if you are going to make sure that every person who achieves those grades has to apply, gets to apply to Oxbridge, do they have to automatically apply for both Oxford and Cambridge? They get to choose? Like, there was no details in this. You've picked two universities, but they automatically qualify for both. What happens here? You can't do that at the moment under UCAS. You have to apply for one. And then they're going to have to do all the interviews. When are they going to do the interviews? And they're going to have to do, at the moment, they're one of the only universities that interviews, like, everyone. I know medics get interviewed in some other courses, but in Oxbridge, it's everyone. It's tough enough for them to schedule it at the moment with, like, being selective about who they interview. How are they going to do it when they have to interview everyone who got, like, an A star at A level? How is that possible? And then even if that is possible, can the government even force them to do that? They're a private institution. Like, Liz Truss doesn't run Oxbridge. She doesn't have, like, how is this possible? I'm just so confused by this policy, and I had this whole rant with my mum about it. Like, I don't understand how this works.
Anyone would have thought we were a student radio station.
Also, I'm pretty sure, I mean, feel free to correct me on this, but don't interviews typically happen before you get your results?
I mean, my interview happened before the UCAS application deadline for
It's got an early application deadline for Oxbridge. On your point of when things changed up, I entirely understand the experience as well. I'm sure you felt the same, Laura, but we were the last year on modular A levels, essentially. Everything went linear year after our. Oh.
They changed humanities a year before to linear, so all of my exams were the new ones.
Oh, and frankly, anyone who's done
them, A-levels.
That is a mess in itself, and let alone changing up the entire schedule, which, frankly, they don't pay teachers enough to have to deal with that. There was no real thought, even as. There was probably some thought put into it, but it wasn't. There was no kind of thinking, is this a practical solution for universities, for schools? Is this at all practical? There was no thought along those lines. I mean, to be fair, I think there's not really all that much else we can say apart from what Vicky's basically said on the matter.
Can we please clip up Vicky going, Liz Truss does not run Oxbridge, because that's made my week.
all I'm going to say is you're going to have to listen out. You're going to have to listen out for the trailer on this one to see what might and might not make it from various different discussions into the fully clipped up trailer and episode. But now that we've sort of shown a small microcosm of just how panicked people can get about the education changes when they're still theoretical, and we basically have no skin in the game considering we'll be out of education predominantly by the time any of these changes come into effect, just imagine what it's going to be like in head teachers' offices, staff rooms up and down the country hearing of these changes.
Especially when they call themselves the education prime minister.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a
Reed
lot.
Blair's calling. He's asking for his nickname back.
Well, I tell you what else is fundamental to get your policy right on, and it's another group of massively overworked people that we've had to rely on a lot in the last year, 2 years, forever, really. But the spotlight's been shone on them heavily in the last 2 years or so. I am, of course, talking about frontline care workers. Specifically, any frontline workers in general would be enough of a story for this bit, but specifically frontline care workers. And I'm using that advisedly because whilst everyone has gone back to the old system of just focus on the NHS, it's very important to remember that when Boris Johnson made his first speech as Prime Minister from the steps of 10 Downing Street, he talked of a social care crisis in the United Kingdom. When Theresa May was making some of her good speeches as Prime Minister from outside Number 10, from in the Houses of Parliament, she was talking about a social care crisis. Scotland's Deputy First Minister has said today, and this is a slight tangent, but it feeds in, that public services are going to need to be cut without additional UK funding. And that is a comment specifically aimed at healthcare services. These are the people who look after us when we are sick. These are the people who take care of our elderly when they are at the end of their life. They are the ones who bring our children into the world for the most part. If we widen the pool, they are the ones who reset our bones when they break, who give us antibiotics when we become ill, who run into burning buildings to pull loved ones out, who put themselves in the line of duty to protect us from the horrific abuses of justice that can happen around the world. Do either of these two candidates have a policy that's going to make me not have to say this speech again by the time the general election comes around?
So I've listened to, I think, all of the debates, and I've read like a lot of what they've written, and I don't think I've heard them talk about the NHS, except for when talking to like a voter who works in the NHS to say thank you for all your hard work. Like, it's surprising how little it has come up, especially considering like reports that have come up during this campaign about backlogs, about people waiting in ambulances, about how rampant it's going to be, but how the problem's only getting worse. To come up with what I think is like no policy, apart from, actually no, that's a lie, Liz Truss said doctors needed to treat more patients, which, I mean, I suppose so. I don't think the problem was that they weren't thinking, they didn't want to treat any more patients, but apart from Liz Truss's let's reintroduce targets because doctors aren't just trying hard enough, I don't think I've heard them talk about it, which is such a shame because it really requires some attention.
It's that and Rishi Sunak's £10 fine for people missing GP appointments, which is just problematic within itself for a number of reasons. I don't know if we want to go into that now. If you listen to any of Expression FM, you know my family have all worked for the NHS, and many of their relatives are, or my relatives are, care workers, etc. The £10 fine, whilst it is like understandable why there's been such a backlog from COVID of so many people needing to see GPs and not able to see GPs or go to hospital appointments, the idea of installing a £10 fine is just problematic for one, going against the principle of the NHS being free, and two, the idea of many people sometimes can't turn up to appointments, aren't even told that they have appointments because there's issues with scheduling or receiving letters, so they are completely unaware of it. I mentioned this to my mum this morning, and she says I'd rather spend £10 to see my GP because I haven't seen one in 3 years. So yeah, that's been a very interesting policy that they decided. I can't believe that out of all the things to not talk about anything to do with NHS or care work or just our healthcare, the one that they come up with is that.
In terms of the GP appointments thing, and I agree with you, completely wrong focus and stuff, I don't have as much a problem with that one as like any, as much of the other policies, because I think if implemented well and with an actual good appeal system, it could potentially help. I don't think it would have an advantage, but
Time out here. We're talking about this government who have cut legal aid for legal appeals on firing. This is a government that has wasted billions of pounds on a test, track and trace system that missed 7/8 of all cases that were reported in the United Kingdom. I don't think we should even be bringing into the conversation sound implementation and a strong appeal system. Sorry, Vicky.
I mean, I agree I wouldn't trust this government to implement it, but I can see what he's getting at. And I know just from personal experience, I know from my local GP, like when I basically, well, when we were pretty certain I'd broken my foot and I was trying to get to a GP appointment so they could refer me to an x-ray, it took 4 weeks to get an appointment because it wasn't an emergency. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to wait an A&E. And the problem my GP has is people cancelling appointments. And I realise it isn't like they had lots of people who would have cancelled their appointments, but then just didn't phone up. And therefore there weren't the backlog was people weren't showing up. And that meant people waiting ages and ages and ages for care. And that really does affect people from not getting shown on to other services, getting the further treatment they need, being recommended to specialists. And I agree, maybe the fine isn't the way to do it. But in terms of how to implement, I completely disagree with a fine for 999 calls when that's been implemented. That obviously doesn't make any sense. But, and I totally agree with Laura that if people aren't aware of a GP appointment, that's obviously a clear issue that does needs to be addressed, because that is one of the reasons people aren't turning up and is causing the backlog in GP appointments, because people can't get any, and maybe try and address that first before implementing a fine. And yes, this government has a bad record, but I can kind of see where he's getting at with, there are some people who just misuse the system, and maybe the fine isn't the way to go at it, but you do need to tackle people just not bothering to cancel an appointment and not turning up, because it is causing huge problems in the service.
Yeah, but the issue with causing backlog is, having a policy of those sort of, if you don't turn up, a policy of there being some action taken if you're not consistently not showing up for GP appointments, by all means. But there's so much more to this backlog. We've got a national shortage of healthcare workers, and we've got frankly, I'm not surprised those who are in healthcare are dropping out or anything like that, because they get treated their pay has been frozen or has risen below inflation for, I think, longer than I've been interested in politics, certainly. I'm getting emotional here, but we're talking about the people who, there is not one person in this country who has not somehow benefited from the NHS. I don't think that's an extreme claim to make. But again, they're just being treated. This implementation of targets, again, in one of them being one of the main other policies, the reason they've got this queue of ambulances outside hospitals is there isn't because doctors are working hard. It isn't because they are lazy. They are working flat out to try deal with the utter menagerie of ailments and silly accidents that we get into as the British public. There are not enough doctors, and they are not treated with the respect they so deserve compared to, and just to say anything other than that is just reprehensible.
I just still can't believe 2 years ago, we were standing in the street clapping the NHS and saying we need to protect the NHS, and it's all about the NHS and well done to our frontline heroes, and now it's just forgotten about. I just can't fathom it.
And it just does go to show that this election, we've heard next to nothing about them when they have been the reason for the 10% rise in national insurance contributions. The reason for one of the biggest differences between the two candidates is the NHS. And in his defence of his own policy, Rishi Sunak is not mentioning the NHS. And in her attacks on that policy, Liz Truss is not mentioning how she would pay for the NHS. Both candidates equally complicit in their ignorance around one of the biggest and most fundamental issues that underpins the foundational elements of public service in this country. It's an astronomical crisis waiting to happen. But speaking of things that are going astronomical, we're going to turn to current affairs, because they have an impact on the way this election is going to go. And there are two I want to focus on. One of them, which is likely to get a heck of a lot worse before it gets better, even in the long term, is the cost of living, with specific relevance to energy. Now, I mean, this is something that I never thought I would have to be saying this early on. Martin Lewis tweeted a couple of days ago, maybe a week or so ago now, that he has heard that average fuel bills could be rising to over £3,000 at the next price cap increase. We've seen the price of petrol at the pump rise. It's now coming down again, slowly. But that's the least of energy concerns right now. We have seen that local councils are thinking and actively planning about opening what are being called warm banks over the winter, similar to food banks. I'm not sure how they'd work, but this is the problem now. We are forcing people, again, consistently now, to choose between heating and eating. And for so long, that has been about, it's the choice between heating and eating. Which one do you give up? Well, now, with the implementation of those potential warm banks in local councils, it looks like the choice is that they can't afford to do either. So have you heard anything that's convinced you that either of these candidates knows what the hell they would do about the cost of energy? And if there's anything that you think should be on the table that these candidates aren't talking about?
I mean, it's one of the downsides of having this leadership election now. Obviously, Boris Johnson needed to go. But the opportunity cost of basically having a prime minister who's a complete lame duck and isn't doing anything other than like enjoying the rest of his time, and two people who are too busy kind of attacking each other rather than being kind of pragmatic and working on what could happen, is we're going to miss 6 weeks of time where there could actually be planning being made for the future and an actual policy agenda being thought about and thought through to be implemented as soon as possible. That just isn't going to happen, and that's going to be longer and longer without people getting any help whatsoever, when like I think both candidates seem to be wanting to wait to see how bad it's going to get before acting, whereas that's just far too late. Once it's got that bad, the impact's happened. You need to be doing work now to stop the impact being as awful. And I can't, what they need to be doing is sitting down and going, okay, no matter which of us gets in, we agree this is a problem. These are some of the solutions we're thinking of. Let's start getting the civil service to think through how we'd be implementing them, if it's theoretically possible, if we could do it, how much it's going to cost. Let's start thinking about like policies. So first day of Parliament after recess, we can put these on the agenda and get some votes going on them. And it's just sad that that's not going to happen.
I mean, speaking candidly, both of these candidates are so far detached from this crisis, genuinely. Like, they don't, at no point, I think, growing up or at any point, have they had to worry about whether, or their families have to worry about whether they can put food on the table or heat their house. They are detached from this issue. We are talking about people who are part of the government whose best advice was that people who were struggling to heat their house could go onto a bus. There aren't words, and I'm sorry, I'm progressively getting more angry as this podcast goes on, and I apologise, but it's just, they are so far detached. There was no genuine policy suggestion from this, and frankly, I hate to say it, but I'm not surprised, because not only are they, as the candidates, detached from this, a whole lot of the people who are going to be voting in this leadership race are going to be detached from this. I mean, we've seen reports of how many expats are going to be able to vote in this race, as well as just general kind of demographics within the Conservative Party. It's not a matter of concern for them, and I worry that is going to be the case when they go into national office as well.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but the only point that I could find on this was from Rishi Sunak and him pushing the idea of insulation, proper insulation in houses, especially of lower income, which is interesting because, and again, I'm looking at Reese to correct me because I know he can jump in. I think, was it around a year ago or probably before, he tried to push the greenhouse grant scheme, offering £10,000 to houses to instill proper insulation, but it was very shortly cut off because it only had a 10% success rate or something around there. Yeah. So I just find it really funny that he's not really learning from what has already happened. And the only thing he's trying to put is insulation, which, yes, it does cut, save you energy. It will save you £230 a year on energy bills, but it costs £500 to install in an average terraced house. And at the moment, not many people can afford it. And I think it links back, especially to what Callum said, and even the small comment before, these people are so far removed from this situation. Even the fact that Rishi Sunak's mug costs £180 to keep his hot drink at the perfect temperature. It is amazing, actually, that these two are running and they're in the top two position for something that, during a time which is such, has such a huge impact on the population around.
I just want to bring in a couple of stats that have been brought up surrounding the energy price debate. Centrica, the company that owns British Gas, reported their profits, their operating profits, in late July. In fact, on the 28th of July, Centrica announced that their operating profits have risen to £1.3 billion. That's five times higher than for the same period of time last year. That's incredible, when apparently they're not passing on those costs to the consumer as much as they could be. In addition, a tweet from the Trade Unions Congress, which caught my eye, the TUC, this was tweeted on the 25th of July. Now, since June 2021, the UK government has spent £2.7 billion bailing out 28 energy companies which have collapsed in that time period. Does anyone want to take a quick guess at how much it is believed to cost, or in fact would cost, to take the big five energy companies into public ownership? Well, I'll tell you. It's £2.85 billion, just £150 million more than we are currently spending to bail out companies that, by the Tories' own economic policy, should no longer exist. So, I don't know. This is a massive, massive debate, and we're never going to have the debate around nationalisation of the energy companies whilst the Conservative Party are in office. I fully accept that. But is it time for the Labour Party to stand up and shout from the rooftops about that sort of statistic? To put some clear blue water, or clear red water, whichever way round you want to see it, between them and the Conservative Party on energy policy? Because right now, as much as I'm not hearing things from Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss about energy policy, what's Keir Starmer said about it, apart from saying Labour can no longer be a party of protest, which we are going to talk about next when we come on to strikes?
The only thing I have heard from, with regards to Sunak and Truss, is I think Truss wanted to, well, one of the policies is to increase corporations like Shell and their trade within the UK by creating low tax zones for trade with them. I don't really understand how it works. I don't think I'm the only one on this call who understands, seeing everyone's reactions right now. Separate to this podcast, messaged everyone here as soon as we found out about the profits that Shell and Centrica and everyone were getting this year. And just the fact that it says profit, just not even how much money they made, it's the profit from it. I think we were all just upset and disgusted, seeing as the time we're in. We've already talked about the cost of living crisis, but I don't think we can push that point enough. Yeah, it is insane that this is happening, and it can happen, but the government aren't talking about it. So, well, the top two aren't, and as you have just said, Labour have become very quiet about it.
Yeah. I was going to add on to that, I'm pretty sure Liz Truss worked at Shell at some point, which is interesting. In terms of whether government should be, whether the Labour Party should be implementing this, I think it would make sense for them to. I think it'd be a good argument, but I could thinking is just purely like political tacticky rather than like what's the best for the most number of people, like what should they be doing. I can kind of see why Starmer would be wary to do it, just because he's so trying to break the image of being Jeremy Corbyn's version of the Labour Party, which was nationalise everything. Which the British public went, no, we don't want to do that. That seems very economically costly and we don't think that's a good idea. And maybe, so I think that might be holding him back somewhat from trying to nationalise anything, because he's just trying to paint himself as a different person. And I mean, it's impossible to tell whether if he went to say nationalise it, the public would get on board. They'd hear statistics like that and go, no, that makes sense. We know how things bands have got. We want the government to run things. Or whether the public would go, oh, we don't think you're being very economically coherent. We don't trust you with public money. You're fulfilling all the stereotypes we have of the Labour Party, all of that stuff that the Conservatives are just going to throw at them, and it's going to cost it to them. So although I can see the benefits behind it, I could also see why Keir Starmer would be cautious about doing it.
Yeah, the energy company, the fact it's brought up so many debates about so many different areas alongside the cost of living and the amount of poor profits they have had when people are having to decide between heating or eating is utterly, and I've said this already, but it is just reprehensible. That but obviously there's other discussions around it as well, including one of which I might have a bit more of a feeling in terms of like obviously climate crisis as well, because we're talking about they've managed to make that many profits, and ostensibly I'm sure that on scale of costs, their investment in more renewable sources, more kind of less environmentally damaging sources, probably a drop in the ocean compared to their profits. I mean, with that sort of money, you could seriously change the infrastructure to something where we, but that's beside the point. The utter silence in terms of policy, both from, or the lack of policy from both the candidates for Conservative leadership and from Starmer at this point. Let's make no mistake, even if it is not directly after, we are fast approaching a general election, even if it's not called as a snap election after the new leader is sworn in. We are, so it is very much in Labour's interest to have some policies at least on the board, at least to kind of test the waters of the general public. And yet Starmer's very quiet in that regard. It, frankly, he's been more, as we'll get onto, he's been more interested in what his person, what in personnel in the party than policy. But yeah, it's been, there's been a lack, not a lack, and at a time where there really should not be a lack of policy on this crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. There's another major crisis, you could perhaps call it, but certainly major political and employment dispute going on right now that you would consider in the past to have been an open goal for the Labour Party, but is now much more of a political tightrope to navigate. I'm, of course, talking about the ever-present, and I really mean at the moment ever-present, threat of new strikes from not only railway workers, as we've seen from the ASLEF have now pulled their drivers on strike, the RMT under Mick Lynch have been front and centre of this latest set of strikes. We've seen baggage handlers at Heathrow go on strike, BA reportedly up for a strike, postal workers, communications workers. Where else? I think I've seen rumours now of a general strike, potentially. Now, that's far, far off in the future. But Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak's approach, the only things I've heard from them about strikes is they shouldn't really be able to happen as regularly, which sounds great as a snippet for Conservative Party members. But if we're talking about potential futures after Brexit, this is an avenue they can now take. Employment law is less secure under the Conservative Party. It's now official. Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak have said as much. So what's going to happen here, guys? We know Liz Truss is now modelling herself on Thatcher. Is she going to become the next big union buster? Is there going to be even more privatisation? Or is it going to be more of a John Major style thing where you never associate him with privatisation, but he was the one who dismantled the railways. Even Thatcher wouldn't touch it.
I mean, I can see it being a big issue that Conservatives want to rail against because it's popular with their members to go against unions. And also, it could be popular with people who would probably, if they sat down and read through everything and thought about like why unions are important for everyone's workers' rights and their rights, are tempted to just see rail strikes and be like, I can't get where I want to be. This is incredibly frustrating. I'm tempted to side with people who want to bust unions because of the inconvenience. And I can understand why people who have been like massively like inconvenienced by strikes and like haven't been able to like get to somewhere really important or have like been left without services for a while would feel that. But it is important to realize that even if you aren't in a union, the presence of unions in other sectors of work protect all our rights because they set standards across the board. It sets standards of like how we all, anyone in any job has. So even if it is really temporarily inconvenient, like I understand the problem with the train strikes. It was annoying me at some point. And you just have to all at those points sit down and go, okay, I'm really unhappy at the moment and the strikes are a really bad time for me. But I do understand why I'm like short-term annoyed, but I have to like prevail against those instances and go, unions are a good idea. The right to strike is a good idea. It makes our society better. And I can see why like that's just going to become a bit of a contentious issue because the short-term anger is enough to rile people up.
I mean, let's be honest, that short-term anger, that annoyance of people saying, oh, my day's been disrupted, is the point of strikes. Is at the end of the day, that is what they are hoping to achieve in some sense. So personally, I was bugged by the fact that when the last row of strikes happened, that some plans fell through. But I was entirely fine with reasoning behind it. You know, I was annoyed that I couldn't do something, but I understood that this was what was, this was because people weren't happy with situations. I believe it was over, oh no, it wasn't over pensions, that's an entirely different strike. Those are the lecturer strikes, which also happened last year. Frankly, what's more concerning than the prospect of further strike action is this discussion, this seemingly genuine suggestion that they'll restrict people's ability to strike, like the ability of the groups like the RMT to call for strikes. That is a fundamental civil liberty, that people right that people in work should be able to have. You should be able to organize, you should be able to strike. And frankly, if they do take that action against the RMT, what's to stop them from doing it against like the junior doctor strikes with the NHS, of any public worker, essentially? What is to stop them from trying to clamp down on that? And it is ostensibly trying to stop people from having their voice heard, which is not what a government should do, especially not a prime minister. There's no place in a free society, regardless, especially with them touting, oh, we're more free after Brexit and all that kind of stuff. If they were to restrict these rights, they have no justification for those claims.
So I think I'm going to bring to an end this particular one on strikes, because I've just noticed the time and realised that we've been recording for over an hour and a half. So congratulations to any listeners who've got this far. Write in. Go to politics.unboxed@outlook.com and we'll get you some kind of certificate. Go for it. A certificate of long-standing service. I want to see how many people write in and get in touch. That'd be a great little way of getting people involved. I wanted to talk about devolution and whether that was safe under the two party candidates, but I'm actually going to park that for its own special episode, where we will talk a lot more about Indie Ref 2, or the potential for it. But whilst I'm on the topic of devolution, I do want to pay tribute to Lord Trimble, who passed away recently, one of the key architects of the Good Friday Agreement and one of the totemic figures of Northern Irish politics. I wonder what he would have to say about current situations involving his beloved part of the world. But I am going to turn now to the final topic for today, before I expire in the heat, which is going to be the state of the race and predictions. And that's not just who's ahead in the polls. It's what on earth is Nadine Dorries doing? It's gone from her talking about £4.50 earrings at Claire's Accessories versus £450 Prada shoes to sharing a doctored image of Rishi Sunak as Marcus Brutus with a knife in the back of Boris Johnson's Julius Caesar in an act which, as far as I am aware, the posting of this photo actually falls foul of her own online safety bill that she put through the House when she is still in her role as Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport. I have absolutely no doubt she will be chucked out of government at the first possible opportunity by Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss by not talking about her at all. I don't think I've heard the name Nadine Dorries out of her mouth once. Whilst Liz Truss is clearly courting Boris Johnson loyalists, she will not let Nadine Dorries have even a copy of the keys back into Parliament, back into this Cabinet office either. In terms of this one scenario, it's in horribly bad taste. Less than a year after the murder of Sir David Amess in his Southend constituency by a stabbing, and I know that this is aimed as a satirical image, but quite frankly, if Nadine Dorries wants to get up on her pedestal and say that MPs should not have that sort of image given to them, shown to them by online trolls, she should not be an online troll to Rishi Sunak in posting that image. If it wasn't so serious, it would be absolutely hilarious that this sort of thing happened, that someone who called out this sort of behaviour was hoisted by their own petard in terms of their own actions. But that's just my little rant about Nadine Dorries. I also want to talk about Ben Wallace, who has come out full guns blazing behind Liz Truss. He wants to stay at the MOD. He's a massive, massive draw for the members. It looks like that endorsement probably wins Liz Truss the leadership election. But the real question that I want to ask, alongside all of these different predictions, is they've already said that there is a place for the other candidate in their cabinet, or words to that effect. So where does Rishi Sunak end up if you think Liz Truss is going to win? And where does Liz Truss end up if you think Rishi Sunak's going to win? So I'm going to let you guys devour that multi-part question while I sit back and try and think of something to close the podcast with.
I mean, linking back to that Nadine Dorries, well, your first Nadine Dorries Claire's accessory tweet, a local story for me. It was my local MP at the DFS. Muted Nadine Dorries. So bit of a local story. It caused a bit of a furore over where I am. And she's growing on us by the day, Angela, our MP, who seems to have had it with Nadine Dorries in a very interesting turn of events. Also linking on the tone of the debate before I get on to your other question. Obviously, there's been a lot of blue on blue. It's been quite vicious. Labour Party have made some very good decisions out of it. I think all of their campaign ads from now on will basically just be the Conservatives trusting the Conservatives, which is a clever mood. And then also, side note, as someone who watched the debates and is a moderately competent debater in myself and has seen some very good debaters debate at competitions, like, the lack of public speaking and debating quality is like almost an affront. It's like, I know what good public speaking sounds like. I know what good debating argument sounds like. And like, it annoys me that it's just being so bad and so like monotone and unpersonable and halting from people who are going to presume what is like the biggest public speaking position in the country when I know how good it can be. But that's like my own side personal note of like anguish over this competition. In terms of cabinet posts, I don't think Rishi actually confirmed this would be in his cabinet. I think she said he'd like look forward to working with her in government. So I think if he wins, he might be looking back on the very careful words of that, maybe give her like a lower role, which she would never accept. So she can't be in cabinet. So he does offer her something, but she's not in cabinet. Maybe she ends up in like a select committee. I don't think it's going to matter what he'd do, because he probably isn't going to be prime minister. In terms of what Liz Truss would do, it's difficult, because the only position he's really suited for is treasurer or anything in the treasury. But he can't be Chancellor of the Exchequer, because he's just spent 6 weeks attacking her economic policies. So I think maybe it's she offers him something out of like politeness, because like she said she'd do it, and then he gives him the chance to turn it down, which I think is probably the more accurate or more likely scenario. Like, she publicly offers him something as a kind of show of truce for coming together, and he says, oh, it's very nice of you, but I'd like to spend some more time with my family and I work on constituency matters, and I'll go back to the backbench. I think that's probably the most likely scenario. You don't really want your leadership rival in the cabinet. It's just an uncomfortable position.
Yeah, I don't think there's all that much to be said in addition to that. But yeah, going to the Nadine Doris point, you obviously mentioned, I mean, frankly, I've for a long time have the philosophy of just not believing what Nadine Doris says in general, I have to be honest, but especially after her comments in Birmingham of saying it was the biggest sporting event in the UK since the Olympics, which my Glaswegian family wasn't necessarily the happiest with. Yeah, but anyway, besides the point, just in general, yeah, it was utterly, it was not reprehensible, but it was utterly, at the very least, there was no thought put into that image going out when it came to the doctored image. There was, or you've mentioned David Armas, but also Joe Cox a few years ago. It is a matter of sensitivity in terms of Parliament, and it is genuinely, in some sense, it's almost a threat of violence in itself. I'm not meaning it was meant to be a threat of violence, but there is definitely those who could interpret it in that sense. And it's, yeah, from the there's been a lot of mudslinging in this race, and by nature of the race itself, there was going to be some, but it seemed a lot more about how can we make the other guys look bad, or what groups can we make look bad, as opposed to how can I make myself look good. It seems to be a lot of the kind of leading candidates approach, essentially. But yeah, in terms of the cabinet positions, I would entirely agree with Vicky's assessment. Whilst there may have been comments about both offering positions in cabinet to their leadership rival on the grounds of possibly sell their own honour, and chances are, even if they're offered, the rival is going to refuse the position.
Yeah, I think spot on with that particular bit. The only thing I will say is that obviously Liz Truss looks like the streets ahead favourite to win this race. I think in political terms, if this goes the other way, it will be the biggest upset in a Conservative leadership race since, I don't know, it's bigger than David Cameron coming out of left field to win in 2005. It's bigger than, I think that it would be the biggest one since Heseltine failed to win the leadership ever, probably. But this is a, Liz Truss is to lose. So in that regard, it looks like both the most recent MPs for Richmond and Yorkshire, Rishi Sunak and William Hague, who's recently come out in support of Rishi Sunak, will be disappointed. I do think that Rishi Sunak will be offered the position of Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster in Liz Truss's government. And I think that if he is persuaded that it serves his interests best, he will accept it. Just because Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster is a prestigious but minimally governmentally effective role. Essentially, it's cabinet office administration. But on the other hand, he could just say, no thanks, I'll go to the back benches, I'll do some speech tours, and I'll get a lot of money. In terms of where I think the rest of the cabinet might go, I'm going to have a go. I'm going to put it on air before they win. I'm going to see where we go. So I think Liz Truss, Prime Minister. Nadim Zahawi keeps his job at Treasury because he's started to cut taxes already. Kemi Badenoch replaces Priti Patel at the Home Office. Ben Wallace stays at Defence, which means I'm tentative, but I think Tom Tugendhat stands a good chance of being offered the position as Liz Truss's replacement at Foreign. But I think out of those big positions, that's my least certain, just because they're so ideologically different, Liz Truss and Tom Tugendhat, even though they're both essentially Cameronite in terms of their fundamental policy beliefs. I think that Women and Equalities is a position that's going to go to Penny Mordaunt because they can't afford to keep this membership favourite out of government. Justice is going to be a tricky one. That's going to be a hard one to fill because I think maybe you'll see Suella Braverman go to the Ministry of Justice just because she ran and she's the former Attorney General. And then I think that education is going to go to Tobias Elwood because he's popular amongst the parliamentary party and he has a reputation for competence in his delivery. And if Liz Truss is going to be the education prime minister, they're going to need someone who can tackle a big job. Anyway, now that I've thoroughly embarrassed myself potentially in the future by putting those predictions out, all that's going to happen now is that Liz Truss is going to completely nuke her campaign and Rishi's going to win. So all of that's going to be completely wrong. But thank you very much to everyone who has listened in to the podcast today. Thank you to Vicky, to Callum and to Laura for being on today's episode. As always, do get in touch if you have any things, any lectures that you want us to cover. You can go through either at politics.unbox on Instagram or have a look for Expression FM News, which is now the page that is handed over. It's all yours, Vicky, and co-head of news, James. But thank you to everyone for listening. We will see you again very soon, hopefully for the next episode of Election Watch. And until then, goodbye.